The following podcast is provided to you free, as is all our content, at drhoffman.com. If you'd like to listen, help support Intelligent Medicine, and get great values by shopping at our supplement store, go to drhoffman.com and click on Shop, then click on the store. Thanks, and enjoy the podcast. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. It's time for this week's clinical focus, and the subject that I've chosen is colon cancer, in particular colon cancer prevention. When we talk about colon cancer, we really need to talk about different stages of colon cancer so that what may be applicable for prevention may or may not be applicable for people who've had colon cancer and want to prevent it from coming back. I often see patients like that. Sometimes, as today, I saw a patient whose 40-year-old sister recently succumbed to colon cancer. And he was looking for advice on what to do to prevent him from getting it in the first place. That's called primary prevention. Secondary prevention is once you've had it, once they think it's been successfully treated and eradicated, then we do secondary prevention to make sure it doesn't come back. And then, of course, there is the unhappy instance where people have advanced colon cancer that has spread, and that's a subject that I'm going to touch on, but I got to admit, I do not know of a surefire natural cure for advanced metastatic colon cancer that is spread throughout the body. It's a very challenging disease to treat, and that's why the accent is on prevention. And what's interesting about colon cancer, I'll give you the statistics in just a moment. Colon cancer is something that is eminently preventable. And I contrast the situation with colon cancer with the situation for breast cancer and for prostate cancer, where now controversy is raging about whether all those mammographies and all those PSA tests are really worthwhile. And I'm not saying they're not, but the process of screening on a regular basis with mammography or PSAs, even rectal examinations, has actually been challenged because it appears that you miss cancers. But worse than that, you may pick up early signs of cancer, cancers that wouldn't have killed people, or ultimately the cancer that you find is so far advanced and so virulent and deadly that doesn't make a difference that treatment is undertaken. So there are actually groups now recommending against screening for breast cancer and against screening for prostate cancer. That's a subject for another day. But definitely there's consensus that screening for colon cancer can prevent death. And that's the key, is, you know, something that it's not just we're discovering colon cancer earlier, but it doesn't make a difference because people die anyway, or alternatively, we're too aggressively treating something and causing people harm. That is not the case with colon cancer. And our main way of detecting colon cancer is via the colonoscopy. But that soon may change. What the statistics show is that colon cancer is the second leading cause of cancer-related deaths in the United States, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. About 132,000 people were diagnosed with the disease as of the latest statistics in 2010, and about 52,000 died from it in a single year. And what we're seeing is we're seeing a worldwide soaring of the incidence of colon cancer as people adopt Western lifestyle. So clearly, going from a sort of a natural lifestyle, a lifestyle that is rural and agrarian, and active, and based on high fiber, natural foods, this is actually moving us towards an epidemic of colon cancer. And right now, the colonoscopy is the mainstay for our treatment of colon cancer. the government-backed U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, which, by the way, came out against routine PSA testing, so they're very conservative. They had some things to say about mammography, also discouraging women from getting early mammographies, urging the women get less frequent mammographies. They didn't rule it out altogether. But the USPSTF, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, recommends that people between the ages of 50 and 75 get screened by colonoscopy every 10 years. That's more of a conservative recommendation than some doctors make. They suggest people get more frequent tests. But actually, it has been suggested that we're over-testing people, that once you've had a couple of normal colonoscopies, in Germany, they've done a study, and this has been adopted by the German Health Service, which is socialized medicine, is that after normal colonoscopies, you can go for as much as 17 years before a subsequent colonoscopy because colon cancer is relatively slow growing. In people who've had polyps, that will be more frequent because a polyp is a sign that there's a predisposition towards cancer, even if the polyps are benign. Or if you have a first-degree relative, a parent or a sibling who has colon cancer, you might be entitled to get a colon cancer at an earlier age. It's not unheard of for people in their 20s and 30s to get colon cancer, although it is relatively rare. Not impossible. Although this is generally a disease that affects older individuals. And, of course, if you have ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease, particularly ulcerative colitis, that because of the chronic inflammation in your intestinal tract, that increases your risk, so you're going to need more screening. So a lot of people don't get screened. I mean, the idea of getting a colonoscopy for a lot of people is daunting, and sometimes they don't have proper health insurance, or sometimes they don't go to the doctor altogether, and they ignore the recommendation that you get your first colonoscopy at the age of 50. I bet there's some of you out there who are like that. You may not have had your first colonoscopy, and although it is recommended. And we had high hopes for something called the virtual colonoscopy. The virtual colonoscopy involves taking a dye in, a dye that will contrast with the walls in the intestine. And I actually have seen demonstrations of how that works. You drink down this dye after a short fast, and then you get CAT scans performed in a virtual colonoscopy, and it completely outlines the contours of your intestine, and it's pretty effective for picking up irregularities in the surface. However, the oral version of this test has not been approved by the FDA. There is a form of the virtual colonoscopy that has been approved by the FDA. But that is a test that involves still getting something injected rectally. The dye is injected rectally, not taken orally, which for some people is, that's the barrier. I mean, say, why don't I just get a colonoscopy? I still have to have something given via enema rectally. And then, oh, by the way, when you get a CT virtual colonoscopy, you're exposed to lots of x-rays, much more than in a normal chest x-ray, because a CAT scan is more powerful. So the virtual colonoscopy, not that popular. Also, some difficulties getting approved by insurance. But here's some amazing news. There's a stool test that just got approved. And it was approved resoundingly by the Food and Drug Administration. I mean, you know of the old stool test, the old-fashioned cards that you would use that would pick up the presence of blood in the stool. Well, the problem is that's nonspecific. Just blood in the stool doesn't necessarily mean you have cancer. It puts you at higher suspicion for cancer, but you could just have a hemorrhoid. The new test is what is called the FIT test, fecal immunochemical test, and it's able to detect with about 92% accuracy the presence of colon cancer. So this is a test that's been long awaited and should really revolutionize the way that we detect and treat colon cancer, and might be an alternative for people who are interested in avoiding the rectal invasion with the colonoscope or with a virtual colonoscopy. The FDA has approved Exact Sciences' Cologuard, that's the brand name, first and only stool DNA non-invasive colorectal cancer screening test. And this is unprecedented. This is the first time in history that a technology has received FDA approval and proposed national insurance coverage by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, who determine whether a test is eligible for insurance coverage. So this is kind of revolutionary. First of all, you know, a lot of tests get approved by the FDA, but then there's a lag time before insurance adopts them. So you say, well, the test is available, but unfortunately, you know, it costs so much that people can't afford the test. This test is expensive. It's $550, so it's not. It's a real fancy stool test, but there's going to be some coverage. An estimated 23 million Americans between 50 and 75 are not getting screened as recommended. And as a result, colorectal cancer remains the second leading cancer killer in the United States. It's preventable. When caught at an early stage, virtually 100% treatable. But if it's caught too late and it penetrates the intestinal wall, or if it spreads to adjacent organs, or worst case scenario, it metastasizes all over the body, it's very hard to treat. For those whose cancer is detected at an early stage, the 5-year survival rate can be greater than 90%. So unfortunately, they say that in more than 60% of all cases, colorectal cancer is not detected until its late stages, making treatment more challenging. And that's an understatement. So how that works: after the physician orders Cologuard, the kit is mailed directly to the patient's home. The patient then collects a stool sample in the Cologuard collection kit and sends the kit back to the Exact Sciences lab for testing through a prepaid mailer. At the lab, the stool sample is analyzed in an automated system to yield a single test result. It's either positive or negative for the presence of precancerous polyps or cancer. Now, what's cool is that it actually picks up the precancerous polyps. Now, the problem is if you've got something suspicious, you're still going to get a colonoscopy, no question. And they're going to go for a tissue sample to see if it's actual cancer. They want to take a look. But at least this test is a screening test that might enable people to require less in the way of expensive and invasive colonoscopies. So this is very cool. It's $599. It's available to patients through their healthcare providers in the United States as of this month. And I think it's really cool. I think I'm going to start utilizing this test with my patients. But we'll get more feedback on its effectiveness with the post-marketing studies. I'm sure they're going to do a lot of those. And I don't know. If I were a gastroenterologist, I would be concerned, because a major source of income of gastroenterologists is colonoscopies. And this is a test that isn't necessarily going to make colonoscopies obsolete, but it may reduce the need for so-called routine colonoscopies. Anyway, that's pretty good news for colon cancer prevention. But what else can we do in terms of colon cancer prevention? There are lots of... that's really what I'm concerned with. And in part one of this podcast, which you're listening to now, I'm going to talk a little bit about diet and lifestyle. And in part two, I'm going to talk about specific supplements that can be utilized to prevent colon cancer. Say you have a first-degree relative who has colon cancer, if you've had a suspicious colonoscopy with polyps present, and you're concerned about the greater likelihood of colon cancer, I'll talk about specific supplements, a program that you can take. And I've seen patients really respond well to that. Often they go back and the polyps don't reappear. So when it comes to lifestyle, we can first talk about the incidence of colon cancer in sedentary individuals. There's actually some studies that suggest that exercise, A, reduces the incidence of colon cancer. It doesn't completely eradicate it. I mean, you can have Olympic athletes who get it, but it will reduce your likelihood of getting it. And also, if you get it and you're recovering from colon cancer, you would do well to undertake an exercise program. So clearly, there is something to be said for that. A study published in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute demonstrated that people who ate at least 6 ounces of red meat had a 35% higher chance of developing colorectal cancer than those who ate very little red meat, less than 1/3 ounce. Now, that, however, is a controversial proposition, and studies have gone back and forth about that. And one of the problems with the meat colon cancer connection is that when they do studies and they do questionnaires to assess people's meat consumption, they often confuse that with the amount of processed meat you eat. And to my knowledge, I don't think they've done a single study that looks specifically at people's consumption of organic meat, meat that is not highly processed. So things like bologna, salami, bacon, things along those lines, they may have a cancer-inducing effect. But I don't think any studies have been done looking at grass-fed beef or other sources of animal protein and the risk of colon cancer. I also think that red meat consumption may be a marker for people who eat less vegetables. It's hard to separate that out. It's, I mean, if you rely heavily on meat in your diet, you may crowd out healthy fruits and vegetables, which have been shown to have a protective effect. So here's a more balanced look at the issue of red meat and colon cancer. It's entitled Red Meat and Colorectal Cancer, A Critical Summary of Prospective Epidemiologic Studies in Obesity Research 2011. And what they say here, they looked at 35 studies. And what they found was, quote, collectively, associations between red meat consumption and colorectal cancer generally weak in magnitude, with most relative risks below 1.5. In other words, there's maybe you know, not a doubling or tripling, but 1.5 times the risk, and not statistically significant, and there's lack of a clear dose-response trend. In other words, people who consume lots and lots of meat don't necessarily get much more cancer. So what it may be, and I've actually participated in studies like this as far back as, the 1970s. I remember participating in a study. I was working at a hospital at the time where they wanted to analyze the stool of meat eaters versus vegetarians. At the time, I was a vegetarian, and I happily contributed my stool sample so that they could study the type of bacteria that were present in the gastrointestinal tract when you were a vegetarian versus a meat eater. And ultimately, that theory did not go that far. They suspected there was a specific bacteria that was encouraged by meat eating that had an inflammatory or carcinogenic effect on the wall of the intestine, and that that was going to be the culprit in colon cancer. So what about the other factor that we often pay attention to in diet, which is sugar and carbohydrates? There is definitely evidence that insulin resistance and overweight and diabetes are associated with colon cancer. That is for sure. And so one might equally say that you should be restricting your carbohydrates and sugar for prevention of colon cancer. There's even some evidence that people who take metformin, which is a drug that helps control insulin, has a beneficial effect in preventing and even treating colon cancer. So the insulin connection is important, and eating a low glycemic diet may be important as long as you don't ignore those important fruits and vegetables which contain beneficial plant substances that prevent colon cancer. What about fiber? There's a guy named Dennis Burkitt who was a surgeon in England, and he went down to Africa to study the Africans because there was a real paradox, is that Africans who came to England, where he practiced, developed lots and lots of colon cancer because they adopted a Western diet. So he went down to Africa and he studied Africans in their natural setting on their original diets, and found that, if you consume a high-fiber diet, your stool will float. He was famous for saying your stool should float because then it's a lighter, fluffier, more fiber-rich stool. But in addition, not hard, you know, pellets that are called sinkers that sink. But that this also conferred protection against many gastrointestinal diseases. In fact, colon cancer is a rarity in African villages under primitive circumstances before adoption of a westernized diet. So it was proposed that people consume a lot of fiber in artificial forms, you know, taking lots of psyllium or oat bran or wheat bran. And actually, studies that look at that do not show that there's that much protection against colon cancer. What it appears to be is that you've got to get the fiber from fresh fruits and vegetables because they contain helpful plant substances in conjunction with the fiber. It may not be the fiber itself. It was thought that speeding intestinal transit would prevent things from literally festering in the intestinal tract and causing inflammation and toxicity. Constipation was thought to be a factor, but and perhaps it is. But the right kind of fiber is the kind of fiber that you derive from fresh fruits and vegetables. That's clear. Also, there's some studies that suggest that consuming soy may reduce colon cancer metastasis. They actually did a study in animals, and what they found was that a constituent of soy called lunacin affects the spread of the disease. And so there may actually be some anti-cancer substances in soy, not necessarily the hormonal substances that prevent cancer spread. And this is, you know, consistent with our experience with apple pectin, modified citrus pectin, which is proposed as a treatment to prevent metastases. There's clearly some benefit in cancers that threaten to metastasize or spread of using modified citrus pectin. It's a powder. It's available in capsules, and usually the dose is about a teaspoon two or three times daily to prevent metastases. So what else is important? Well, it appears that where you live in the world is important, because there's greater likelihood of getting cancer in the temporal regions, the north and southern hemispheres, rather than at the equator. And this suggests that there is a light connection. This is the work of the brothers Garland at University of California, San Diego, Cedric Garland, and I forget the name of his brother. But they did work showing that maybe, just maybe, light exposure, long winters, lack of the vitamin D that gets produced with sunlight can increase the risk of cancer. So clearly that ushers in a new set of considerations, which we'll cover in part two of our podcast. Today's clinical focus is colon cancer, its treatment and prevention. And we'll talk a little bit about plausible supplement strategies for addressing colon cancer in part two. So stay tuned. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.